I get my material, at least to start off with, from a man who wrote an article in the Harvard Business Review 20 years ago. This article is almost invariably reprinted in every collection of articles on business ethics, every anthology, and it also has the claim to fame that it, more than any other article printed in the history of the Harvard Business Review, received more letters to the editor than anything that had ever been printed, and I think it still holds the record for that. It must have something going for it or against it to have this kind of fallout. So the first thing I want to do is to run by you this intriguing argument by a man named Albert Carr in this famous article called "Is Business Bluffing Ethical?" It's the title of it. If anybody runs a question like that for a title, if I were Jimmy the Greek, I'd place big odds that his answer is probably yes, it is ethical. And since this is a rather incredible thesis to try and defend, let me run by you in short compass what some of the major moves are in this argument designed to convince you that business bluffing is ethical. Then we'll talk about whether this argument really washes. But I don't know whether we can do all this by 4 o'clock, but you know, it's often said that philosophy bakes no bread. I mean, what practical utility is philosophy? Well, I think there are some important issues which are spin-offs from this Albert Carr article. Some things which I think are worth talking about is, and you'll see how this will just follow right on the heels of Carr. Do we even need an agency like the FTC to be the watchdog for deceptive advertising? Maybe we should just scrap it. There's a sense in which Carr's article and all the implications follow from it would indicate, well, there's one more government agency that King Newt could probably do away with and save the taxpayer some money. On the other hand, if we think there is a place or a reason for being for the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, what standard should that organization use to determine when an ad is deceptive? I mean, what sort of criteria should be used by the FTC to determine whether an ad is deceptive? You'll see why this is a very important question. If you think that we should have an FTC, after all is said and done, and that they should go after deceptive advertising, and assuming we know what deceptive advertising is, there's the lingering question as to whether all deceptive ads, all things which meet the criterion of being deceptive, are worthy of FTC intervention. So there are a lot of practical issues which are operative here. Well, let's start with Carr's argument in this article called "Is Business Bluffing Ethical?" What does he mean by bluffing? Well, he says what he means by bluffing are things like this. He's talking about in an advertising vein. Conscious misstatements by an advertiser. Concealment of pertinent facts by an advertiser. Exaggeration by an advertiser. All of these he judges to be perfectly ethical reasons we'll get to. I was trying to think of some examples of what he means by each of these. Concealment of pertinent facts. Many moons ago, Shell gasoline, I remember these ads, advertised that Shell contained platformate, which was some sort of additive to gasoline which gave you greater gas mileage. And then it would show you an aerial view of two cars on like the Utah salt flats or something, two cars, and a car on the right had shell but without platform 8, and a car on the left had shell with platform 8. Okay? And so these two cars start up, and they each put a gallon of gasoline in each of these cars. And of course, the car on the right ends up you know, getting out of gas a lot earlier, and the car on the left, the one with the platform 8, just goes on and on and on. Now, I take it that we're supposed to infer from this that we should get the shell with platform 8 in order to get greater mileage in a car. Well, the problem here is that platform 8 was an additive to gasoline, and platform 8 was simply Shell's name for an additive which every other gasoline on the market had. So they weren't unique in having this additive. Did they conceal pertinent facts? Probably. But all in the name of trying to get you to ante up for Shell rather than maybe Amoco. Exaggeration is part of bluffing. You know, I'm thinking of face creams which say, you know, that the wrinkles will, you know, melt away and you'll look years younger, you know, by using this thing. Well, maybe those little tiny hairline wrinkles might be masked by this kind of stuff, but, you know, it's rather exaggerated if you think you're going to look like Christie Brinkley, you know, if you're well into your 60s. It's just not going to happen. Well, what is Carr's argument for this as to why this kind of game playing is really ethical? Well, he concedes right at the outset that if you're a Christian, if you're just an ordinary American, that when you see unmasked some of these advertising techniques and that he's talking about here, you'll say, well, that's just deception. And deception is morally wrong. And what else? I mean, how can somebody come along and say that bluffing, deception in this mode is really ethical? And he said, well, he understands that that's going to be the first rejoinder against his argument, but he thinks the beginning of wisdom is for us to all recognize that we actually live in a culture with a multiplicity of moral rule books. And that one of the rule books, which is operative in our culture, he baptizes the business ethics rule book. He claims that you can't be in business for more than 20 minutes and you know that there's a set of rules by which people play by, which are very different than those preached in the churches and the kind of rules that govern ordinary life. Maybe we practice the golden rule, you know, in Christianity, but you know, in business, they practice what is called the brazen rule. Do unto others as you would not have them do unto you, but do it first. Okay? There's a whole new ballgame when you're in the business world. And if you plumb the depths of business ethics, you'll find that it's really very simple. An act is right, according to business ethics, first of all, according to him, if it doesn't violate the letter of the law. And secondly, if it turns a profit. Now, if it satisfies those two criteria, just muse on this. I mean, is he on to something? If it satisfies those two criteria, if it doesn't violate the letter of the law, the spirit of the law is something else, but if it doesn't violate the letter of the law and it turns a profit, it's right. Now, he is suggesting that we can learn a lot about the ethics of business from the ethics of poker. He thinks it's a very good analogy. Let me read you this purple paragraph in which he's trying to make his case. It says, we can learn a good deal about the nature of business by comparing it with poker. While both have a large element of chance, in the long run, the winner is the man who plays with a steady skill in both games. In both games, ultimate victory requires, first of all, intimate knowledge of the rules, in this case, what the law will allow or not allow. insight into the psychology of the other players here, you know, the consumers, the other competitors. A bold front, a considerable amount of self-discipline, and lastly, the ability to respond swiftly and effectively to opportunities provided by chance. Now listen to this. No one expects poker to be played on the ethical principles preached in churches. In poker, it's right and proper to bluff a friend out of the rewards of being dealt a good hand. A player feels no more than a slight twinge of sympathy, if that. If with no more than a single ace in his hand, he strips a heavy loser who holds a pair of the rest of his chips. It was up to the other guy to protect himself. In the words of an excellent poker player, former President Harry Truman, if you can't stand the heat, then stay out of the kitchen. If one shows mercy to a loser in poker, well, that's a personal gesture divorced from the rules of the game. Business is like poker. If you can't stand the heat, then stay out of the kitchen. What Carr is ending up saying here is that very few of us say boo about some guy that strips a heavy loser in poker who had a better hand out of the rest of his chips, you know, because he's got a single ace, he bluffs him out. Very few of us think that that's wrong because the rules of poker allow that. I mean, it's up to you to protect yourself. So business can be looked at nicely through the lens of a poker analogy. Now, let's get back to the fact that all these kinds of forms of bluffing, concealment of pertinent facts, and exaggeration, and so forth. Let's get back to the fact that from the Christian perspective, this strikes us as not telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. It's called deception. And you know, if we raise that particular issue with Carr, then he has a rather interesting answer. He said, look, there are at least two moral rule books. We've got, call it Jewish Christian ethics or the ethics preached in the churches, and then we've got business ethics, and there may be other countercultural rule books and so forth, but here's the point he's trying to make. It's simply illogical and irrelevant to judge the behavior of people playing poker by other than the rules of poker. I mean, to come in and say, well, now you just deceived that guy. You bluffed him out of the earnings he would have had from having been dealt a good. I mean, if you come in with that, the poker player simply says, I'm sorry, that's a gigantic exercise in irrelevancy. We're not playing by those rules. We're playing by the rules of poker, which is the right answer. I mean, if somebody sees me out on a green lawn and I'm kicking a ball around, and somebody comes in and says, hey, you can't do that. And I said, what do you mean, why? He says, you just violated the rules of soccer. I said, well, I'm sorry, but I'm playing football. So catch me, you know, an infraction of the rules I'm playing by, and we have something to talk about. Otherwise, you have nothing to talk to me about. Now, you sort of get the picture as to what Carr is in effect saying to people who would say, you know, but these kinds of bluffing in advertising is deception. He would simply say, well, now there you go again. You see, now you're judging us, players in the marketplace, by a rule book that we're not playing by. You might as well blame somebody for violating a rule of soccer when he's actually playing football, or bring wrath down on somebody who bluffs somebody out from a good hand in poker. So then we say, well, now you just deceived that guy. Well, I mean, that's part of the game. So there's this rather interesting thesis operative here that we have a sort of insulatedness among these rule books, and that the only rule book that a person is rightfully judged by is the one that he or she is playing by. Otherwise, we have nothing to talk about. But there's another interesting claim which is operative here. Carr insists that everybody around the poker table knows that all the other guys at the table are not going to tell the truth. They are. And this raises a rather interesting question. I mean, it's a lot like in advertising. I mean, I know you as someone around the table with me, that you're not going to tell me the truth about what your hand is. I mean, I know that, and you know that about me. Now listen to an axiom that Carr accepts, which seems to whitewash even advertising. Well, let me build the case a little further. If you're a producer of products or goods or services out there, you know doggone well that all your competitors are going to try and use this concealment of pertinent facts and exaggeration and so on. I mean, you know that. And here's an interesting axiom to entertain. Ponder this. Falsehood ceases to be falsehood when it's understood on all sides that the truth is not intended to be spoken. Listen to this. Falsehood ceases to be falsehood when it's understood on all sides that the truth is not intended to be spoken. Now, let me pick up where Carr leaves off and just run this a little bit. Let me give you an example. A while back, there was some advertising for close-up toothpaste or something. There was some frat guy just adjusting his tie and everything, and he was going out, and his fraternity brother says, "Hey, you know, what's going on?" He says, "Well, I got a heavy date, you know, with Betty or something." And his frat brother says, you know, hands him a tube of close-up toothpaste, says, "Put your money where your mouth is, you know, use close-up." And so you see him, you know, scrub-a-dubbing, you know, his pearlies and everything. And of course, then you have some words about close-up toothpaste and everything. And of course, then the segue is back when he's coming back from his date. And his roommate asks, "Well, how did it go?" And he says, you know, and you're supposed to get the idea that close-up toothpaste will make you lucky at love. I mean, that this is obvious here. Well, let's just, I'm trying to bait you because I think this is the way Carr would go. Suppose you had a roommate that saw this particular advertisement, and he went and used close-up toothpaste, and he went on like two or three dates, and they were universally rotten, absolutely rotten. And he finally came back and said to you, "I tell you, that stuff doesn't work. That's just false advertising." Well, I mean, you would say, "Well, have we been living under a rock?" Here's the point. Don't we all know that Madison Avenue is not going to tell us the truth? Don't we know that? I mean, to be of age is to know that. I mean, they're not in there to make us good logicians. They're not in there to give us little aesthetic treats that you see in art museums. They're in to move goods and services. I mean, don't you know that you're not going to get the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but of course you do. Does Madison Avenue know that you know that? Yeah. Well, now ponder this. Falsehood ceases to be falsehood when it's understood on all sides that the truth is not intended to be spoken. Where's the ethical problem?
I'm going to talk about kids' toys and advertisements that go with cartoons. And when we showed our kids one ad that they showed how they did the ad 14, 15 times and cut it to the very best pictures and put the ad together, the kids got a big aha that what they saw on TV was not the real way the thing was going to run or the thing was going to be done. But we have to educate the kids so that they don't want everything that's on TV.
Well, I've had the same experience. I would sort of like to confine our discussion to
adults
over 18, but I think children's advertising is a whole different ball of wax that may have to operate with different rules. I mean, how many, I mean, there may have to be tighter squeezes than what advertisers can do. But let me tell you a story out of my own life and then second guess how Carr would respond to this. There was a time, a period back when our boys were really young, and they saw an advertisement on TV on Saturday morning cartoons. It was prior to Christmas, about these little race cars, you know, that went around a track and so forth, and they were battery operated, And these, geez, they had real exciting music playing, real close-ups of these cars going, you know, geez, and the noise and everything, and this great music, and they really wanted that for Christmas. So they wanted to hit Nancy and I up to buy this from them. Well, we had a bad case of ingrown pockets, and I mean, we said, no, no, you can't, no, you're not going to get that for Christmas. Well, unfortunately, they got money, you know, shekels, dollars, you know, from grandparents and uncles and so forth. So the two of them pooled their resources so that we could go down after Christmas and get this. Well, we got it home, and geez, these cards are only about an inch and a half long, and, you know, it took about an hour and a half to get the track together. And of course, it would always go off the track.
Yes.
And everything, and there weren't all these, I mean, all these sounds and everything, and there wasn't exciting music. And you know how much those two guys paid? I mean, they paid like $30 between themselves. They're out, and they're just disappointed as hell. And I think Carr would say, well, when are they going to learn? They got to learn sometime. I mean, they probably won't do that again. I mean, what are you going to protect them all your life? I mean, this is how he would respond. How would you respond to this? I mean, you know, they probably won't do that again, but they got to learn sometime.
With that, the baby talk dolls.
Pardon?
The big baby talk dolls when the girls were young. And I wouldn't buy them, but they convinced their one of their grandfathers to buy them.
And
they hated them. They took the batteries, and then they went soft or cuddly, and they didn't really do the talking right. It was funny. I'd say the original packaging of the store was bad.
Well, anyway, maybe I've said enough to know that you're dealing with an interesting argument. I mean, this is, you have this feel like there's something wrong with this particular argument somewhere, and I can't put my finger on it. Let me give you one, yeah.
What about flat-out lies, like the doctors have never proved that cigarettes are bad for the health, which the tobacco industry maintains?
Oh, well, let's get to this, because one of the things, I've already showed my hand partly, one of the things we have to talk about here is, I mean, if we're going to talk about deceptive advertising, at first sight it's very tempting to simply put an equation sign between lying. Say, well, it's just lying, that's what I mean. Well, yeah, but we're going to have to then ask whether you want to put an equal sign between lying and deceiving. They may well be different kinds. Well, somebody comes out and makes a statement which is blatantly false. I mean, I would suggest we're on our way toward a lie, although you need more than pot in order to do it. But I just think, just on a thumbnail quick survey, that most of the ads which trouble the FTC are not lies. They're deceivings, and just what that difference is, we'll have to get to in a minute. Here's one worry that I have about Carr's argument. There's a strategy in logic for indirectly trying to beat off an argument, and it's called a reduction to absurdity strategy. And this strategy basically is the party says, okay, let's assume what the commentator has said is true. Let's assume to be true. Now let's see what logically follows from this. And if cockamamie things follow from an assumed truth, there's got to be something wrong in that premise set somewhere. We can't just ambush exactly where it is, but something's wrong upstairs in the argument. Here's the problem that I've got with at least one part of the argument. Once you start getting committed to this notion that a person can only be judged by the moral rule book they're playing by, I think we're off into the hinterland. Because then I can start seeing people like Charlie Manson, you know, coming in and simply say, oh, you think that what we did to Sharon Tate and so forth, you know, was bad. But you have to understand that me and my accomplices here don't regard that as bad. Now, you may, but there you go again, judging us by a rule book we're not playing with. Now, I'm starting to get a little skitsy about this because I think Jeff Dahmer could come in and simply say, oh, you have problems with me eating heads and killing people and so forth. Well, I mean, that's your rule book. I think Adolf Hitler could end up saying the same thing. It licenses the possibility of purely private rule books. So I'm worried about the general line of reasoning because it ends up seeming to me to certify, you know, purely private rule books. Well, let's lying versus deceiving. Let me give you a couple examples of what I'm talking about here. I would suggest that if you had an ad, if I can find a thing, if some aspirin type thing came on the market and said, Paragon pain reliever gets into your bloodstream faster than any other analgesic. Now that strikes me as a claim that is capable of being falsified. If it's in fact false that Paragon pain reliever gets into your bloodstream faster than any other, then that's a bald-faced lie. In fact, let's just take a look here. What I try to do just to prime the pump is to lay out some criteria for what has to be the case in order for it to be said that somebody's lied to somebody else. And then I'll show you why this is an insufficient analysis. Somebody A lies to another person B if and only if, first of all, A makes a statement that A believes to be false, and A intends that B accept the statement as true. Now, if somebody came along and said, Paragon pain reliever gets into your body faster than any other analgesic, and Paragon understands that that's not true, then it's making a statement that it believes to be false. I mean, it knows it to be false, with the intention that the hearer accept it as being true. But that would then count as a lie. But, you know, all lies are not created equal. It seems to me, look, let's just test this for adequacy here. Suppose I came to you and said, there's an elephant in that closet over there. Am I making a statement that I know to be false?
Mm-hmm.
Am I intending that you accept the statement as true?
No.
Why?
We know there aren't any elephants up here. It's too cold.
I can't possibly intend that you accept the statement as true because it's so bonkers. You know, I can't have this intention because I know that anybody with a grain of intelligence. This fails to be a lie because the second thing fails. Not long ago, or maybe 15 years, some undergarment outfit for women was called Distinction Foundation Garments. They ran an ad that said, a woman in Distinction Foundations is so beautiful that all other women will want to kill her. Well, now wait a minute. Is Distinction making a statement that it believes to be false? Right. Does it intend for you to accept it? I don't know. That's sort of like the elephant in the closet. I mean, that really isn't going to work. It can't be a lie. Let me thicken the plot a little bit. I've given you the elephant in the closet, the Distinction Foundations, and what we're saying here is that nobody would take any of those things literally. I mean, you have to be living under a rock or something. You got to be demented in order to fall for that. So you can't get along. How about this? Suppose some producer of a good or service makes a claim which it believes to be false, but there are some people out there who interpret it as true, although most people don't. Now what are we going to say about this? We're saying reasonable people would never believe this. But then there are some strange people out there that will believe it. And I'm sort of baiting you here, because ultimately what I'd like to have us talk about is what shall be the standard that the FTC shall use to determine whether something, whether an ad is deceptive. This is a true story, I mean, to illustrate the point here. I don't live in Pennsylvania, but I'm told that in Pittsburgh, there's a local brewery, and it's called Iron City Beer. And every Christmas around, or every year around Christmas time, they package up Iron City Beer with a funny kind of label. I mean, it's the same stuff, and everybody knows what's going on here, and it's called Old Frothing Slosh Ale. You know, it's got a couple of moose, you know, next to each other, crests and everything. And then it's advertised as the Pale Stale Ale for the Pale Stale Male. And then on the bottom, it has this claim to fame. It's the only beer brewed in America where the head is on the bottom of the glass. Well, some woman in Pittsburgh. I mean, you know where I'm going. I mean, she's going to have a Christmas party. And she went out and bought two cases of Old Frothing Slosh, and she was chagrined to find that when their guest poured it in the glass, the head was on the top, just like every other day. And she now goes, I'm not kidding, she goes to get an attorney to challenge Iron City Beer Company for false advertising. Well, the attorney says, forget it, you know, I cost a lot of money, and no judge, you're going to get laughed out of court. Okay, but she took this seriously. She was lied to. Well, now, wait a minute. When the FTC is looking around to determine what standard shall be used to determine whether an ad is deceptive, I think one thing we're going to learn, it sure can't, you can't have an ad wash as deceptive for prosecution purposes by the FTC if it could deceive anybody. Because they were going to turn out the cuckoos that, you know, that would fall for something like this. So you can't have the standard, something called the gullible consumer. If there's anybody out there that could fall for it, then it's deceptive. Can you imagine the agenda the FTC would have if you bought into that particular standard?
So is this like the Joe Isuzu ads, that he's lying, you know, on the screen there it says he's lying, and he's telling you this stuff, and it says he's lying, and the ad is...
I haven't seen this. This sounds great.
Oh, yeah?
No.
Oh, what's the guy? He had his own TV show for a little while, and he tells you this bizarre, crazy stuff about Isuzu automobiles, and then on the bottom of the screen, and the letters come on, it says he's lying. And so he's telling you bizarre stuff, and it's telling you he's lying, and that is the ad. It catches your eye. It's the same guy, Jerry Della Famina, who wrote a book about advertising called, when he was hired by Toyota, his ad was, from the folks who brought you Pearl Harbor. And they did not hire
That's
him.
Awful.
But he does, you know, he does all this crazy stuff. But I mean, that was the ad, and it was all to get you to recognize the product, Isuzu. You know, who ever heard of it?
Well, I'm sure we could all share yarns about this, you know, being a philosopher and trying to drive some philosophical points here.
But I mean, that whole thing of it's nobody would believe it.
Right.
But, you know, and you're looking at the ad going, that's unbelievable, but it's supposed to be. It's supposed to catch your eye. The unbelievable catches
your eye. Well, it's not lying then. Right?
Yes.
It's not lying. Okay. Testing, this is the test now. Ocean Spray cranberry juice got nailed by the FTC not long ago because they had a commercial that ran, Ocean Spray contains more food energy than any other breakfast drink.
Breakfast drink.
That's the way they advertise it.
Yeah, but
okay.
It's the same difference from the juice.
What?
If they use breakfast drink, and they're saying breakfast juice, they're saying breakfast drink.
It doesn't matter, because that's not what the FTC moved in on. The FTC, after this ad had run a while, it went to Ocean Spray and said, look, we've tested your particular product, we've had chemical laboratories, And you haven't got any more vitamins and minerals, you know, in this than there is in any other breakfast drink. And Ocean Spray says, that's not what we said. We said it contained more food energy than any other breakfast drink. And the FTC said, well, no, wait a minute. And then Ocean Spray takes the aggressive stance and simply said, you ever had biology 101? I mean, food energy is measured in calories. I mean, the U.S. Bureau of Standard measures food energy in terms of calories. The FTC says, but no, wait a minute. Would you have come out and said that that Ocean Spray contains more calories? I mean, no one would do that. I mean, and what they're maintaining is that you and I, or the average consumer or something, think when we hear food energy, we think vitamins and minerals. Well, no, wait, let's just test this. Ocean Spray makes a statement that it believes to be false. Is that right?
Yeah, it wasn't false.
No.
Well, it's over. The ball game's over. I mean, it ain't lying because it fails with both of these conditions have to obtain or be fulfilled to have a lie. So it ain't a lie. How about this? Cutesy soap helps keep your skin young. Now, let's just live with that for a minute. Cutesy soap helps keep your skin young. Suppose people take the word helps and interpret it as definitely will deliver. Well, did the advertiser make a statement that the advertiser believed to be false? No. Well, what happened here? Well, we had some slippage on the interpretive side, right? Mm-hmm. Only Zenith has chromacolor. So? What? Well, no, wait, not think about this, people. Only Zenith. You know what most people do? They take the claim to exclusivity, the claim that only this product has got this, and infer a claim to superiority, don't they? The claim to exclusivity licenses a claim to superiority. I mean, in a minute, you can look at that and say, oh, well, that's not a good line of argument. I mean, I could say only Leinenkugel's beer contains pink food color. Mm-hmm. So, simply because it alone is a product that has some sort of a thing, we infer superiority. Did Zenith make a claim that it believed to be false?
No.
Problems on the interpretive side. I mean, it's almost embarrassing for someone to point out that if I have made this illogical inference, a claim to superiority based on a claim to exclusivity, it's a little embarrassing to find out that that's a logically invalid argument. You know, we say, shame on you for falling for that, right? So we're embarrassed. I mean, we can't put the hit, really, on the advertiser. Of course, one of the things that you wonder sometimes is whether the advertisers are banking on us going on these banana peel slides. I mean, whether they have damn good reason to believe, you know, that we're going to do this. Now, because they're not telling lies, at the first sign of a cold, take Coracidin. Well, you know what most people think? That Coracidin is a cure for a cold. They do.
What is it?
Well, it's a symptomatic relief.
It's an antihistamine.
I mean, that's all it is, but a lot of people infer that it's a cure. Now, I don't think Coracidin is lying. But somehow you say something's awry here. I mean, it's not lying, but some sort of shenanigans is going on, and this is why we may have to distinguish lying from deception. Deception may be another form of non-truth telling, and it could be that, in fact, it is. This is what takes up most of the days of people at the FTC. Let me we're going to run out of time here. Let me just read a plausible definition of deception, so you can see how it differs from lying. And you can't buy this definition in any store because it was made up by me. I've never seen anybody try and define deception. But let's say that somebody A deceives somebody else B, if and only if, first of all, A makes a statement from which A expects that B will draw, that is, infer a false conclusion. And secondly, to have a real deception going, A fails to provide any information which would prevent this false conclusion from being drawn. Now think about that. I mean, deception occurs when somebody A makes a statement which the statement maker expects the person to whom the statement is made to make a false inference, but gives no information, doesn't go on to give the information that would head off the path to making that inference. And I think this Ocean Spray ads and so forth, you know, fulfill that. And I think that that's mostly what the FTC is after.
Why do you require that they have to give information? I mean, why can't you just stop saying that they made a statement that they want you to believe is true for deception?
If it is true, then there's not a moral problem, and there can't be a legal problem, I think.
But if it's not true.
Yeah. I mean, the problem here is that if you make a bald-faced lie, say something which you know isn't true and the other party accepts it as being true, that's one thing. You could make a statement which is true as it stands, but you have very good reason to believe that the hearer is going to infer something else which is false. And that's, I think, where deception comes in.
You think on the long-distance phone companies that anyone's telling the truth? AT&T, MCI, Sprint.
Sure.
They're all telling the truth?
I don't know the answer. So as consumers, what do we do?
We do research.
Carr would say, don't trust them.
Yes, the trouble
is, I mean, we don't need an FTC. I think that's where Carr would simply say, I mean, for those over 18, we don't need an FTC out there fighting battles for those over 18. If you don't know already that the advertiser isn't going to tell you the truth, I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, we don't even need an FTC. I mean, just the rule of thumb is copy it out there, buyer beware. We don't need an FTC. If you don't know right now that you got to watch yourself, why should there be a big brother out there?
But it could be for kids' things, for things under 18.
That may be a different order of business. It may be.
Actually, they're playing on the lack of knowledge of their consumers or the ignorance of their consumers, like the Ocean Spray.
Yeah.
That anyone knows carbohydrates are energy foods, so they don't have a lot of carbohydrates.
But anything to move goods.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Remember, advertisement is not there to make us good logicians. It's not there to give us aesthetic jollies like Gauguin paintings. Or it's there to move goods and services. And it's dog eat dog.
But don't you think, like they have the 10 best ads in the world, and most of them come from France and Japan, that they're cute ads. And the ones that we like are the cute ads. We like the elephant swimming over to get the Diet Coke. And we like the polar bears waiting for Coke to come down. I mean, there's some cute ads out there that we like. I don't know if we buy the products because of that. But I think most of us fast forward or walk away from some of these ads that are on TV. I mean, we don't sit and watch them.
But isn't necessarily the cute ads itself. The purpose of advertising is to put the name there.
Right.
Yes.
And even if it aggravates you, the fact that the name is there, it's going to stick in your mind.
See, at X number of times you go to the store, oh, that's a familiar product. You pull it off the shelf.
It's like one politician said that you could be arrested for shooting your own mother, but if it was a week before the election, people would have forgotten what you did or remembered the name when they saw it on the ballot. It was probably true.
Okay, I want to test you now. Are these ads deceptive? And then I want to ask, well, if they are, so what? Should the FTC go after them? New Gillette Soft and Dry stick deodorant claims no other solid keeps you drier. Now, what the facts are about this is when you do a Yankelevich survey, most people think that what they just heard, no other solid keeps you drier, they hear that soft and dry keeps you more dry than any other stick deodorant. Now, is that what was said?
No, I interpreted it.
See? Right. I mean, there could be products out there that keeps you as dry, but this is not a claim to superiority. There's an inference on the part of the consumer to superiority.
They could all have the same active ingredients and keep you equally dry.
Now, suppose you could prove that most people make this illicit inference. Should the FTC go after that? Because what people are hearing is that soft and dry keeps you more dry than any other stick deodorant. Now, should the FTC go at that and say, you're involved in deception because we've just done a Harris poll which shows that most Americans, just like the Ocean Spray, read it that way. I mean, what do you think about this? Do you think the FTC should move in because most people make this wrong inference? No? Is there a Quaker sense of the meaning that no?
Not unless it wants to start defining the language again.
And it's not dangerous. I mean, it's not going to kill under your arms. I'm worried about things that are death-provoking, things that are not fireproof, that say they're fireproof, things that say that they aren't sinkable and they sink. Those are the things I worry about.
Okay, let me move on, because what's coming down the pike here is this interesting thing. I don't know what your judgment is about this soft and dry ad, whether it's deceptive or not. You see, this may be a judgment call. It might be deceptive in an empirical sense if you could show that most people read a message into it, which in fact isn't there. Objectively, it's deceptive. But somebody with a clear head and good logical mind would never make this kind of false interest, false inference. Here, let's get to some points that you made. Stouffer's Lean Cuisine used to boast never more than a gram of sodium. Now, I'll tell you that's true. Can you see a problem here?
Gram of sodium holds 1,000 milligrams.
This is the problem right there, is that nutritionists measure sodium in thousands of a gram. A gram is a lot of salt. So, never more than a gram of sodium. Well, my Lord, I mean, that's not false. But suppose most people infer, oh, well, that's low sodium. Let me get on the Lean Cuisine train. Can you see a problem here? Now what's the problem? We have a health problem in the offing. Even if you judge that this was deceptive by our empirical criterion, some of them which end up being deceptive by that criterion say, don't let the FTC go after that. It's not worth it. Now here, we may have a health problem going. Entenmann's fat-free chocolate loaf cake boasts a scant 70 calories per 1 ounce serving.
1 ounce serving is pretty small.
Do you know how small 1 ounce is? I mean, it's one of those things, if you're cutting the loaf and you cut it and it would fall off the table and go, probably, you know, but like this.
Like the sign of those cars on the ads.
Well, now, you see, here's a problem. If we accept our empirical definition of deception, does it in fact communicate, do most people in fact infer something different? maybe it's not just the bald question of whether it is deceptive, but whether there are some other harms beyond the deception. Okay? Now we seem to be making progress. We don't want, simply because something is deceptive, do we want the FTC moving in? Now we're suggesting, well, it depends on what other things are at stake. Health might be at stake. Now, let's go back to the standard of deception. And this is sort of like a ping pong game. And then we'll come back and ask, well, what sorts of harms beyond mere deceiving do we want to have out there as criteria for the FTC to move in? Here's a problem the FTC has had over the course of its history. It started out with a definition of deception, that an ad was deceptive, now listen to this, if it would deceive a reasonable person. Now that's built right out of tort law, civil law, a reasonable person standard, okay? Well, you can probably just smell the problems here. How would you know a reasonable person if you ran into them? I mean, what is this reasonable person that an ad would have to deceive? It's certainly not our lady friend in Pittsburgh that actually believed the head's going to be on. I mean, she doesn't qualify. But now, how would I know the reasonable person? Suppose I go into a grocery store, and there are cans of pop there. They're loose cans, you know, Acme Pop. And it says 16 cents a can. Oh, and right next to the individual cans are these shrink-wrapped six-packs. And so now I have a choice. I can pick them up, and it says 16 cents a can or six for a dollar. Well, I might as well get my money's worth, so I pick up a six-pack. Now let's do this math. 16 times 6 is 96 cents. Or they offered me six for a buck.
Mm-hmm. It's a valuable shrink wrap.
That must be it. But you see, I'm probably going to ineluctably reach for the shrink wrap stuff because I think that if I buy more, I usually get it. I mean, you know, I just go with this.
Depends on if you had a good teacher or not. You knew your man.
Now I want to know. I want to know. Am I a reasonable consumer?
Sure.
Careful. I mean, reasonable consumer.
If you were, you'd have a calculator. You can do it in your head. You'd figure out which one's the best.
You see where we're going to go, and this is exactly the problem the FTC got into. Once you broach the reasonable consumer as the standard, and then you start giving examples like this, now it sounds like the reasonable consumer, we have to pump it up to the perfectly reasonable consumer, right? Which looks familiar, like God. I mean, and who roves the halls of grocery stores, never making any of these fallacious inferences? I mean, then we wouldn't prosecute anybody, right? Now we got a criterion that doesn't work because the reasonable consumer ends up being a perfectly reasonable consumer, and nobody's that, and so the FTC has got nothing to do. So, so where do we go here? I mean, what should be the standard that the FTC uses to judge whether an ad is deceptive? And it's jockeying between the reasonable consumer, then went off the deep end to the perfectly reasonable consumer, and they abandoned that. And where they're at right now, like it or not, is the average consumer. Now, the average consumer is what we've been talking about all along, namely, if you stuck a microphone in the face of various people and simply say, when somebody says food energy, what do you hear? You know, and they would say, well, I think that means vitamins and minerals. I mean, that would be the average person. And if you could show that the average person makes these inferences, then you've got just cause for the FTC moving in. But, now wait. Do we really want the FTC doing that? Suppose, let's take a heart case. Let's go back to Lyme. Suppose Paragon Pain Reliever, is it 4 o'clock?
Even with a watch.
Audio wipe.
Oh.
The bill is up run.
Well, the problem is I'm supposed to be in a meeting. Next door here. Technically, this is supposed to, we're supposed to get the gong at 4 o'clock. Well, a couple of party shots. I mean, points to the ponder. Paragon pain reliever gets in your bloodstream faster than any other analgesic. Now, we've already judged that. Let's suppose that that's just false. And it's a lie. Okay, let's take the real hard case. Now, let's just suppose that somebody buys Paragon pain reliever according to the client, that it gets into your bloodstream faster than any other analgesic. She buys it for this reason. But as a matter of fact, what is true about it is that it gets in your bloodstream as fast as the fastest one in the market. I mean, that's the truth. Not faster, but as fast.